This is Lawrence Tuning, and these are my 88 friends.
Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will sing you a song that will help me along. They're my one-man band. I'm the number one fan.
Our guest today is our friend Stan Kennedy, who was something of a regional legend around here. Every guitar player that I know around here, if you mention this man's name, they sort of light up and have a sort of awe about him. He is a pastor in the Pentecostal Holiness denomination. He's been an evangelist, a singer, but most people, when you mention his name, they always want to talk about his phenomenal expertise at the guitar. He's actually taught a lot of people guitar lessons. Join us now for our interview with Stan Kennedy. Welcome to our show, Stan.
It's good to be here with you, Lawrence, especially, you know, as long as you and I have been friends and actually get to collaborate together on something like this. It's an honor to be on your program.
Well, likewise. Where were you brought up and born?
Well, I was born and raised in North Carolina. I am the son of a pastor who pastored in the Church of God, Cleveland, Tennessee. Matter of fact, my mom and dad met at Cleveland, Tennessee. Dad's out of Mississippi. Mom's from Anderson County, upstate South Carolina. Yeah.
It's so funny. You make me laugh there, because I was raised in the Church of God, Anderson, Indiana, and they always identify the town.
Well,
we're Cleveland. Well, we're Anderson.
So you know, well, I guess I could have characterized it. You know, Church of God. You know, I'm talking about the Tower of Power, Church of God. You know, he had left. Just got started teaching school and had to surrender to the call to preach down in Mississippi, and went to Lee College. Mom had finished nursing school in Anderson and went from there to Lee, and what put them together was music. They both, the school was conducting auditions to put together a Lee College trio to travel and represent the school. And so they each won a spot in that.
And that school is famous for a training ground for great singers. I think some of Rascal Flatts actually went to.
I know at least one of the guys did. Yeah.
Went
and
to school
then another
there.
Another young man, I think, that won.
Won the Voice. Jordan Smith.
Yeah, there you go.
He went there.
Right.
So your dad had to quit that to the call. You ever heard that story about the guy who couldn't preach his way out of a paper bag? He was horrible.
I hope that story's not about me.
Me neither. But he went to the Lord in prayer one time. He said, "Lord, you gave me a sign. I was to preach. I was kneeling. I was praying, and I saw this vision of this in the sky. The clouds formed the letters." PC. So, of course, I knew that you were saying preach Christ. And then you heard the voice of the Lord said, I was really saying plow corn. You just didn't interpret it right. Did you come to the Lord as a child?
I did. I was actually, maybe there are people who feel that you can't come to the Lord at this age, but I went to the altar one Sunday night at the age of 6.
Yeah, I was 8.
And myself and my son, Jay, who is a pastor in Columbia, were born again at the age of 6. Now, my wife and our two daughters were born again at the age of 4. Now, somebody asked me about that. I said, you know, how did they come to the Lord so early? I said, well, I guess myself and Jay were just such hardened sinners at four, the Lord had to work. Want us a couple more years to bring us along, you know.
So when did you realize that you had this thing for guitars?
Well, I had always, you know, I started off in music. When I was in primary school, there were piano lessons for about 3 years. I remember playing a couple of recitals. I mean, the old John Thompson.
Oh, yeah.
Starter Up.
The Kangarooster and Wigwam, all those.
That kind of thing.
Classics.
And then I let my playing in the woods buddy shame me out of continuing piano lessons because it wasn't manly, you know.
Oh, believe me. We could spend all day talking about that.
Yeah.
I got a guitar player right now. Wonderful guitar player. I wish you could meet him. You would be very proud of him. But I interviewed him one time, and he said that I used to play piano, but I figured that it wasn't cool to be a piano player. So you guitar players were always a lot cooler than piano players.
They always said, you know, guitar players, they always get the chicks.
They do.
But
hey, how well I know in the band, it's the drummer and the guitar player.
Yeah.
All the girls wanted them, but the piano player, you know.
Well, you know, in the culture I came up with and the type of people I rub shoulders with, the reason the drummer made sure he got a girl is because he probably needed a place to stay, you know. But anyway, so about third grade, I dropped off of piano lessons, which I've regretted since. But and then in the sixth grade, when I started sixth grade, I took up the trumpet in sixth grade band and stayed with that until my freshman year of high school, played in the marching band freshman year. But while I was also while I was in the sixth grade, I started picking around on my dad's flat top guitar. Uh-huh. And then after a while, by the time I was done with the first, my freshman year in high school, the trumpet went away and I was full stream with guitar. And so that's kind of.
Wow. So you really started guitar fairly late a lot of people start earlier than that.
Yeah. Well, I was actually just before turning 12 when I really started. There was a guy in my mother's Sunday school class at High Point who they came to a Christmas party at the parsonage, and he had a baritone uke. And this is, of course, when folk music was, you know, really getting their wheels under him, you know.
Yeah.
And so he brought that baritone guitar. And so I talked him into letting me, you know, showing me three or four chords on it. And I sat in there while they were eating and whatever and playing those four chords on that four-string ukulele. Later that week, I discovered that the tuning on the four strings of that baritone ukulele were the actual exactly the same as the first four high strings on my dad's guitar.
Wow.
So then I was good to go then. So I learned how to play "Oh, Give Me a Home Where the Buffalo Roam," you know, the chords to that. And so that was it. And so I kept pecking away at it.
Who were your guitar influences?
Well, I had, I was, you know, just playing rhythm and maybe an occasional pick note or two up until I was somewhere. I'll tell you what happened. In the summer between my freshman year and my sophomore year, I decided I wanted to learn how to play like Chet Atkins.
I can see some of his influence in some of the things you play.
And so I, you know, Mom had bought me a couple of his records and albums. And so I would listen to that, and then I figured out his, you know, in the songs he was playing in 4/4 time, you know, the cut time. I kind of figured out his base thumb pattern.
Right.
And so, long story short, I made myself up drills in order to establish the independence between the thumb and the finger. Now, how I knew how to do that at 14, who knows? But I'll never forget, we came home from church one Sunday, and there were these people who sang gospel music on the local radio station. They weren't great singers by any stretch of the imagination. But as always, I'd come home while Mom was getting, you know, lunch on the table, and I'd put the guitar around my neck, you know. And so they were singing I Am a Pilgrim. And it just so happened that it was in the key of E. And I had heard it played Chet Atkins style in the key of E. And so I started thumping along with them. And before it was over, I said, "Hey, man, I'm playing I'm a Pilgrim," you know, and that great Merle Travis song, you know. And so then I was off and running. I couldn't be stopped then.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to a show called Me and My 88 Friends. This is Lawrence Turner, your host. Our guest this week is Stan Kennedy, who is a pastor, but who has quite a reputation as a wonderful guitarist. We've been talking about his life, his journey with Christ, but also his journey as a guitar player. He played a few songs for us for this episode, and I want to play one now. Stan played a couple of secular songs, and then later he played some gospel songs. This is a song from the Doobie Brothers many years ago, but he has a jazz version of it called Taking It to the Streets. There's a strong jazz influence here. You mentioned Chet Atkins.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Well, I was neck deep into Chet Atkins for, you know, the early days of my high school, on in through my high school, because essentially I ended up making a living playing that style. But my obsession with Chet Atkins, you know, increased my record collection by him. And so in the mid to later 60s, he started including some bossa nova selections.
Yeah.
You know, because it was the late 50s, early 60s that Charlie Byrd imported bossa nova from Brazil,
right?
You know, to the States up in the Washington area. And it just took, you know, got some traction, a good bit of traction. And so I liked that music. And so I started picking some of that up. And then along about the same time, I was, you know, so I was buying guitar albums of people outside of, you know, Chet Atkins and all.
Right.
And so I got, you know, Wes Montgomery, Johnny Smith, Howard Roberts, people yeah. like that. And so, and I liked the sound of the jazz. And so I started, you know, I don't know, I guess it's just by osmosis. So it sort of, as you can see in my playing, it became a kind of an amalgamation.
Oh, it's wonderful. Now, you were raised in a strict holiness denomination, we would probably say. In the old days, I know a lot of them were.
Yeah.
But did you ever have any resistance from either your parents or other Christians who thought you shouldn't be listening to jazz or that you're getting worldly on us?
Not so much, because it was mostly confined to home and, you know, maybe an occasional jam session. Well, to be fair, during that time, nobody else at my age was playing any jazz.
Yeah.
Or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I was playing stuff that nobody else played. So finding somewhere that to plug that in was kind of slim pickings, you know.
Did you play rock and roll, too?
I got to where I could, but I wasn't that interested in it.
Uh-huh.
Because I viewed the rock playing that I had heard as a skill level appreciably below what I was listening to. You know,
yeah.
liked, you know, and of course, you know, obviously people took that to some supersonic heights. But mom was a big influence, because she, you know, she had been a singer and everything. And her motto in nursing school was variety is the spice of life. She's the one who got me a Les Paul Mary Ford record when the only thing I'd been listening to was Chet Atkins.
They had some great records, the
yeah,
two of them.
And she, you know, she said something like this, and it kind of resonated with me, that said, the only person you ever listened to is Chet Atkins, you'll never be any better than his last album.
That is really...
Now,
ahead of her time, to have
really,
your mother say something like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Usually your mothers
so she wanted, yeah,
tend to.
She had been exposed to stuff out there. Of course, she grew up in the, you know, the 30s, into the 40s. So you know what kind of music was being played there. And so they were into the rich harmonies, you know, the stacked harmonies and all that stuff. But so I took it to heart. Of course, now, in the final analysis, I never really became as good as Chet's first album.
Well,
you know, forget about being only as good as his last album, but
you're a humble man.
Because of that, I assimilated elements of these styles and
yeah. Who's your favorite guitar player of all time, or your top three or four?
Okay. Wow. That's a tough sell, but tough decision. But of course, number one, Chet Atkins, because he's the reason I can play any. Because you know, if you could get his style under your hand, some of those voicings and chord forms became so usable in the jazz and
right.
the other stuff. So it was a bridge to that. So Chet Atkins, number one. A guy I really well. The next guy was. It's probably a tie between Wes Montgomery, who's famous, and a lesser known jazz guitarist but very influential, Johnny Smith.
Uh-huh.
And, but one of my big favorites nowadays, and currently, I'd probably characterize him, I say that guardedly because I don't want to offend my thumb picker buddies, but Earl Clue.
Our friend Stan Kennedy, who is our guest today, graced us with a version of the classic hymn, What a Friend We Have in Jesus, done in his own distinctive way.
I started getting asked to do gospel recording sessions on other people's records over in Hickory. And so a couple of musicians were farmed in from a group out of Spartanburg called the Pine Ridge Boys.
I've heard of them, yeah.
And so they got to talking to me about doing some traveling with them and playing guitar. And so I thought about it. I said, well, maybe it'd be good if I took a one semester break from school, and maybe I can get my head together on this major thing. So I traveled with them, and 2 weeks into it, the first tenor singer, who was also the bass player, left and moved back to Fort Worth, Texas, and that threw me to singing first tenor.
Yeah.
And, of course, I had been president of my high school choir, the community college choir in school, so singing wasn't a foreign concept to me, you know. But so long story short, we played a fair date in Anderson in September of that year, and we opened for a group out of Atlanta, Georgia, famous long-standing group, the Lefevers.
Oh, absolutely. Eva May, Mylon, of course, a lot of my generation will remember Mylon Lefevre,
yeah.
who really became rock and roll
singer. Yeah, Alvin Lee 10 years after, yeah.
Yeah, and friends with George Harrison, Eric Clapton, yeah. All those guys. I guess, I don't know if I told you, but Mylon comes to our church once a year.
I didn't know that.
And preaches. He's a preacher now. So.
Oh, yes, I knew that.
Yeah. So the Lefevres, they are legendary
right.
group. So and you met them?
They started talking to me at intermission at that fair in Anderson and started talking to me about possibly considering coming with them. So I put them off for a little while. I went to Nashville during the quartet convention to formally audition. And I did, and then they offered me the job. And so I went back home, worked 2 more weeks, you know, not to leave Pine Ridge Boys high and dry, you know. And then made the move to Atlanta over in October. And 2 weeks later, 2 sisters out of Charleston came with the group, who happened to be the daughters of a Pentecostal holiness pastor.
I gotcha.
Anyway.
I kind of see where this is going now.
I married one of them.
Yeah.
And so, as they say, the rest is history. They actually hired me as a first tenor singer. And then the guitar playing was just gravy, you know. But after I got with the group, I ended up playing more than I sang. I could hear harmonies very well. So, you know, wherever they needed something, I could do it, you know. And if it required a higher note, I was there. But I went in fall of 72, and in the summer of 73, Sharon and I left to get married.
Okay, so almost a year.
About a year, yeah. And we, I figured that I didn't like the idea of being newlywed and traveling all over the place, you know, and so I came back home, went back to school in North Carolina. She went home, started planning a wedding.
What school did you go to in North Carolina?
Well, I went to Western Piedmont Community College because I had never finished an associate degree there before I left to go on the road. So, but anyway, it was I've got friends that I still communicate with just from that brief travel of full-time professional gospel music.
Now, at that time you were in the Lefevres, I think Mylon was that in the middle of his wild phase.
Yeah, I remember 1 week.
He became a heroin addict and the whole works.
Well, yeah. I remember his mother telling us about him taking, well, which back then was a fortune, $10,000 out of the bank, because he was traveling with Alvin Lee at the time.
Right.
But he took $10,000 out of the bank, went over and sat in a castle with George Harrison and smoked pot.
I know that she would ask people to pray for her son.
Yeah.
And God honored those prayers.
Yeah.
He's been used by the Lord.
Sharon actually used to babysit for he and Ann. Ann was working at a medical office. And she babysat Summer when she was very little.
When you got married, you got out of the traveling professional music.
Right.
And when did you feel God wanted you to begin to preach?
Well, I guess the Lord let me walk a little bit of path so to learn what I wasn't ever going to be good at. He let me fail at a few things. Of course, school got interrupted with the beginning of a family and increased responsibilities, you know. And the recessions served to make me a little bit more laterally mobile. I'd been in middle management in a textile concern in Morganton, North Carolina. At the same time, I was still going to school to try to finish up there, and then ended up in, matter of fact, that's what caused me to have to leave school, because they put me on it. They moved me to a first shift in department management. Anyway, so there I went. And, of course, that started going away because of what happened to the textile industry, you know, in the mid-70s. Short story, we ended up moving to South Carolina for a job that my father-in-law had sort of connected the dots for me. And, of course, he wanted his daughter and grandson down there, I'm sure. So he had an incentive for seeing what he could find for us. We moved down to the South Carolina below King's Tree.
Yeah.
And I started working with an insurance company. Of course, there was a drought the next year, and a lot of the proceeds, the income base was agriculturally.
Right.
Agriculture. And agriculture didn't much happen that year. And so guess what? Insurance policies weren't happening so much either.
Yeah.
Which meant that my household income wasn't right. happening so much. So anyway, long story short, but while we were still there, August 1st, 1977, just a little backstory. I'd gone to the pastor of the church that we were attending, who my wife had known when they were pastoring in Lancaster.
Yeah.
And there was this gentleman was up there, and they liked him. So when he found out he had a church that was pretty close by, she wanted to go to that, because I didn't know the PH guys, so much. And so I went to him and let him know, look, whatever I can do to help you, So he took me on visitation with him a few times. Then he called me to the parsonage in the summer, sometime in July. And he told me, Stan, that I've got to go to Oklahoma City for general conference, early August. I'm going to be gone two Wednesdays and the Sunday in between. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I want you to take care of the services while I'm gone. To which I responded, well, sure, Brother Sam. Sam, I'll be more than happy to take care of the services. Now, I got to tell you, my idea of taking care of the services was making the announcements.
Yeah.
Maybe taking prayer requests, taking up the offering, and then introducing whoever the guest speaker that was farmed in that morning.
You were going to chair the service.
Yeah, I was just going to be the master of ceremonies, as it were.
Yeah.
And which I'd actually never done before either, but, I was willing to do it. So I said, I'll be happy to. My next question was, who's going to preach? And Pastor Sam looked at me and he said, why, you are. I just about fell in the floor. But I said, well, Pastor Sam, I can't tell you I'm called to preach. He pointed his finger at me and said, now, didn't you tell me that whatever I needed you to do, you'd do it? And I said, yes, I did. And so I was on the hook for four services, live, die, sink, or swim. So before the first Wednesday night, I made it my business to stop by that church and get in that sanctuary. And because I what in the world am I going to preach? What in the world can I possibly preach? And I remember with my Bible open, I had a notebook there, and I'd pulled a table out into the front area of the sanctuary right by the good window light. And I remember, and I was trying to study, and I couldn't come up with anything. So I laid my head down on the Bible and said, Lord, I can't do this unless I know for sure that you're actually calling me to preach. And while my head was laying down there, Lawrence, I saw in my mind's eye the top, the page heading of 2 Timothy 4. Hmm. And I didn't know enough Bible yet to... So I tried to turn to it. Matter of fact, turned past it and then had to come back to it. So I found that, I found that page in my Bible. I said, yeah, that looks just like what I saw. And so I started reading it out loud. I'll charge you before the quick and the dead, before the Lord who shall judge the quick and the dead at his appearing. And that was verse one. And I thought, well, that's good, but not really speaking directly to me. And I put my eyes back down. I said, well, I'll read the next verse. The first three words of verse two were, preach the word. And something went off on the inside of me. And from that moment, I still have the note where I wrote out the confirmation of my call to preach.
No doubt after that, huh?
No, never a doubt. I still have that note, handwritten note, August the 1st, 1977, in that same Bible at the house.
So that's been 40-something years.
5 years this August. 45 years this August, yeah. And
isn't that the same passage that says, do it instant, in season, and out of season?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah.
Whether you feel like it or not.
Right.
Whether the season looks like you're going to have a harvest or not, do it. And so you've pastored various churches. Right now you're pastoring in Myrtle Beach.
Myrtle Beach, yeah. Coincidentally, my first very first job in the ministry was right here in Florence. I was the, no qualifications. I got called to preach but didn't get to go to Bible school, I got some Bible, some certified Bible education in later years.
Right.
But I was a minister of music, the first paid minister of music at Christian Assembly Church.
Yeah.
Over here.
Wow.
And
now, we're not talking about that particular church, but were you here in town? There was a well-known incident that happened in one of the churches around here where they had a Singspiration night that meant anybody could sing, like the fifth Sunday. That's when those who aren't usually called to sing. It's open mic night.
Yeah.
And I heard there was a lady they called up to the front.
I think I know where you're going.
Somebody asked her to sing what she sang. The last time she said, well, I've written a song.
Both of them were songs that she wrote. The first one was too.
So, tell me if I got this right. And I was told, now don't faint when you hear the first line.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with syllables.
It does require a disclaimer.
Yeah. You're dealing with syllables with hyphens in between. But from what I heard, she got up there and she said, well, God gave me the song. And we're like, well, I feel like hell. I feel like hell. I feel like helping someone today. Were you there?
I was not there, but I was in a band with the new pastor, fresh out of Bible school, for whom that was his second Sunday.
Okay.
His pastor. He had gone there to start off the previous Sunday and moved in the ensuing week. And that's what he had to deal with on Sunday night. And so it was I've told that so much through the years. Called him. Well, I've asked him. I said, "Are you sure it went like that?" And he's always verified it was exactly like that. And when I tell him, I said, "Now listen, there are, you know, all usage of the hyphen are not necessarily edifying." I mean, it kind of works, you know, that kind of mechanism works with everybody ought to know.
Yeah.
Everybody ought to know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that way you're not leaving somebody hanging literally over hell, you know. A very good friend of mine, he was pastoring church on a particular Sunday. In this particular church, they'd have a Sunday school preliminary, Sunday school, and a Sunday school post-preliminary before transitioning to the worship service.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Sunday school superintendent would be able to give his spiel, you know, after service, you know, after the Sunday school. And they'd always sing a song before Sunday school and sing a song after. So when he finished his remarks before transitioning to the worship service, he was heard to say this. He said, "Now I want you to turn in your hymnal," and I'm just picking a number. He said, "Turn to number 437, and in commemoration of Father's Day, let's join together and sing Father Along."
That's a true story.
And that's, as the comedian said, that's the truth of my hand up. Because I was very good friends with the pastor at the time.
Well, speaking of Father Along, we're going to have you sing and play Father Along.
Sounds good. By and by. had to run some high hurdles when my daughter went to heaven, you know, because it brought up on the screen, okay, some questions I need to ask. I even, you know, wrote them out. And
so I'm glad you're talking about this, because there's so many. I know tragedies come and it just shakes them. We've all been through that at times, where it really shakes you. Like, okay, where were you, God? When?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, you know, the devil will try to leverage everything that happens in your life against you. And I'll never forget the very first thought that came to me. And I've been preaching, you know, what I had studied and learned and assimilated and still believe all my ministry. But then when my precious daughter went to be with the Lord, first thing, thought that came was, well, what you going to preach now? Mm. And then the next thought was, and if you think you still can preach, are you even going to be qualified to preach? You know, pointing it up that what had happened, if I can't accuse what we'd been standing on, then the accusation falls on me that I failed at it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, either way, I lose.
That's right.
You know, and so I had to run a few high hurdles for a few months. I mean, I'd already committed. I'm not getting out of the ministry. I preached my daughter's funeral. And and I don't want to elaborate over long, but a story that helped me, because like I said, I'd written what to me were legitimate questions about faith, believing God, which involves in God's faithfulness. And, you know, and one of them kind of was around the idea, well, does, you know, God makes promises. That's clear to see in the Bible. But does he just take liberties to play fast and loose with his own promises? Mm-hmm. You know? And, I mean, are they not reliable? And I'd written things like that out. And I remember I stopped by our conference offices one day. Of course, this is when I was still doing hospice work. And I went and spoke to who our general assistant superintendent at the time, good friend of mine, who, by the way, just last month lost his 33-year-old son in a tragic auto. And our daughter's 32. And I sat down with him, you know, and telling him. And so I mentioned a couple of things. He and I were good friends, and mentioned a couple of things, you know, some of those things I was struggling with. You know, I'm trying to go forward in ministry, but, you know, I feel like I've been dinged up pretty good. And he related a story to me that involves Mylon LeFevre.
Okay.
He said, and this was after Mylon had his, you know, this is his heart diagnosis that, you know, where he went through a health crisis. And said he was off on a, you know, almost a medically recommended vacation at some ocean resort area, and said he was just walking along the beach one day, and two people were sitting up further up the beach on the beach chairs under an umbrella. Happened to be Ken and Gloria Copeland. Uh-huh. And Mylon came walking by later down below him, and I was told that Gloria said to Ken, I believe that's, I know that man. And so somehow or another they made the connection. And, of course, Mylon told him his diagnosis was a death sentence. And, but they started meeting with him. He started coming to their room, and, you know, and you can think what you want to about Kenneth Copeland, anybody, you know, whatever, but the word's still right.
Right.
You know, the word is still right.
Yeah.
And so he met with them for the balance of that week in their room. You know, so it was about a week long. He came every day, and they taught him about principles of faith and, you know, kind of encouraged him. So on the last day when Milam was having to leave, he came by their room. And here's the part of this that helped me the most, Lawrence. He said, Ken looked at him, Kenneth Copeland looked at him with those steel blue eyes, you know, and he was, you know, giving him his last instruction. And Milam was about to have to leave, and Ken pointed his finger. He said, I'm going to tell you this. He said, now, we've given you enough to turn things around if you'll use it. He said, but whether you get healed or not, I'm not changing my message.
Yeah.
And that really landed on me. I was walking out of that office up the hall, and the Lord spoke to me going up that hall, because I had those questions written out on a small hand-sized legal pad, maybe yellow, you know, the yellow sheet. And I went up the hall, and the Lord said, now, when you get to the car, tear that sheet out of there, of that notebook, and wad it up and throw it away. And I did.
Wow. And it settled it.
It settled it. It settled it.
You still probably don't have all the answers, but
I don't have all the answers.
Enough.
But I still have the Bible. One thing the Lord told me long, long time ago, he said, human experience is not necessarily a infallibly reliable commentary on God's word. But he followed with saying,
that's a message that this generation, this age needs to hear. We're so feeling oriented.
Yeah, yeah.
And subjective.
Well, the second half of this will really bring that in focus. I'll repeat the first. Human experience is not necessarily a reliable commentary on God's word. But God's word is the only infallibly reliable commentary on human experience.
Oh my goodness. I need to memorize
that. That dog will hunt, won't it?
Say it one more time.
Okay. Human experience is not an infallible commentary on God's word. You know, you can't take human experience and say, well, see, that's not right. But he said, God's word, on the other hand, is the only reliable and infallible commentary on human experience.
Well, on that note, I can't think of anything more profound to close with.
Wow, yeah.
Thank you for listening to episode 73 of Me and My 88 Friends with our very special guest, Stan Kennedy. I couldn't let Stan leave the building and drive back to Myrtle Beach without at least suggesting to him that the two of us play a song together. So we decided to play the song Holy Fire, which I wrote back in 1995. So here's Stan Kennedy and yours truly playing Holy Fire. Hope you'll tune in again next week and tell your friends about the show. God bless. give me strength for the task. Take me high, close to thee. This is all that I ask. Here I am, send me forth. Feels all right, time is short. Hear my plea, fall on me, Holy Fire. Hear my plea, just fall on me, Holy
friends. Some are black, some are white, they are precious in my sight. Some are quiet, some are loud, some stand out in a crowd. Me and my 88, me and my 88 friends. We've been friends for a long, long time, ever since I was old enough to climb up on a piano stool and get to know them one by one. Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. Some are black, some are white, they are precious in my sight. Some are high, some are low.